Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here tonight because I'm still in Glasgow at the CHI conference, the Human Computer Interaction Conference. And at this conference over the years I've interviewed or had conversations with a whole lot of interesting people. Will Sim, Oliver Bates, Bran Knowles, Mariangela Ferrario, Adrian Clear and Vanessa Thomas. And all of those people have got something in common. And that is Professor Adrian Friday from the University of Lancaster.
Hello.
And I finally convinced him to sit behind a microphone.
I didn't run away fast enough.
Thank you for joining me.
It's a great pleasure. I really like what you're trying to do with the podcast and the chance to kind of tell people why I try and do what I try and do, I guess, which is not necessarily the thing that will rapidly advance someone's career, but I think is important.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the south of England. I grew up, which I guess is not far from London, which is where, you know, the engine of growth in the UK is. And I guess I lived in the south for half my life, and then I moved up to Lancaster in the northwest, which is a much more rural and I would say sociable place to live, and I settled there with my family and had a couple of kids, and I've been there ever since.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, what an excellent question. I think I never knew what I wanted to be, which is why I became an academic. And I've always been motivated by, I think academics are often motivated by the diversity and challenge in the job. You know, they want to solve problems and they want to do things at the forefront of knowledge and that, you know, maybe have some impact. And it's never dull as a profession. So
you probably weren't thinking that far ahead when you were making those decisions when you were 16 or 17.
No, I guess as a kid I thought I was going to be, I was utterly obsessed with computers. It was the birth of the microcomputer revolution. I had a Texas Instruments 99/4A, which didn't do much. And you switch the thing on, and you got nothing. You know, what you had to do was make it do something, and you started coding. And I remember my parents buying it for me for Christmas because they knew I was interested at school, and they couldn't get it to work. I came in, and my first basic program, you know, I spotted the typo on the page straight away, and they were like, oh. But I was hooked. I was hooked in creating software and creating software for people.
Were you seeing it as an intellectual challenge or something, a vehicle for achieving something?
I think I just loved creating new things. It was everything from, you know, writing a program to catalogue all the music tapes I had, right through to little bits of games, and you know, whatever itch I wanted to scratch, I'd create a program to scratch it. And so I, you know, probably no surprise, that was the subject I did well at school. I worked for a software house writing bits of games, as I was a student, and in my summer vacations at university, and then I went off to work for a software house. And I honestly thought that was the most boring job in the world. I couldn't stand it. It might have been the company I was working for. No disrespect to them. I'm not going to name them. I got an offer to do a PhD. I went to a couple of places. Again, I won't name where they are, but one of them was at Lancaster, and I talked to Professor Gordon Blair, and he just really excited me. It was at the birth of mobile data and mobile computing, and it was a whole new horizon about mobile communication was opening up, and that really excited me. And it took me into mobile computing and then into ubiquitous computing.
And those sort of the promise of ubiquitous computing has delivered, and maybe not in terms of the utility, but in terms of the number of computers.
Ubiquitous computing is about computing everywhere, but it's also a kind of about a vision for the future. It's about natural interaction beyond the keyboard, interaction with voice, with gesture, implicit and explicit interaction, a symbiosis of the computational world and the social sort of human world. And I think that I used to read a lot of science fiction as a kid. I think I got fired up at the idea that you were creating this sort of future and enabling new things. Probably now Kai would accuse me of techno-utopianism or something, but that's a fair criticism, by the way.
So let's cut to the chase. Can computing save the world?
Ooh, now there's a question. I think computing has a role to play in saving the world, because I think two things. I think computing helps us understand the world. I think it gives us new ways of engaging with people, measuring things, gathering evidence, and understanding things at a scale you can't otherwise do. And I think it's also true that computational systems reshape the world anyway. They allow us to interact in different ways. They change the way people do dating and meet their partners and buy their shopping and drive their cars. And we put computational systems in the world, and they shape societal systems, and societal systems have impact on the world in terms of environment and resources and carbon footprint and energy footprint. So I think on my optimistic days, I think by creating better systems, we can shape those processes to be more sustainable. But I do think they have a role, and that's what my work is mainly about, in helping me understand the systems as they are and where the impacts are in those systems.
One of the problems of technology, but technology I'm thinking right down to light switches, is that we've been really, really good at making the impacts invisible.
Absolutely.
We turn the light on, and turn the switch and the light comes on. And if we take that up a few steps to our big connected information entertainment systems, that we're even more so disconnected from that than impact.
I think we've, and this is part of the reason I'm at Kai actually, we think of design affordances in terms of making things more convenient, more streamlined, making the interactions slicker and hiding the impacts further. So you take the paper we've got today, actually, it was really about saying when you watch TV on your phone, you are streaming data, you're causing data demand in data centers, you're using content delivery networks. All of these things have an externality, and this has a cost. And an interesting question for us as a discipline is how do you start to think about designs that make those externalities more transparent or more accountable, so you can design systems
but without being a party pooper?
Yes, I think you have to be a bit of a party pooper, because there are business models and the ways we choose to run society and the way those businesses run that want to see more demand. They want to see you watching more content, because then they can put more adverts in your face, which then generates more revenue for them. And as a society, I think we have to hold that to account. And as sort of scientists, in a sense, I think it is our responsibility to say, hang on a second, we are creating systems that are putting more computers into our homes just so you can switch the lights on, with an extra energy footprint or with an extra resource footprint. And I think it is our responsibility to kind of try and highlight that these are elements of design that are not currently factored into our design practices and our software engineering.
So if I have a sort of system that enables me to say, hey Siri, turn the lights on.
Yeah.
What sort of impact are we talking about?
Are you asking for watts? I would hesitate to put a number because I would get it wrong. I think we are, if you try and unpack that, what you've got is the energy cost of the always-on device that's listening for your voice. You've got the network communication between you and the cloud data centers that are sending your voice to the cloud for processing. You've got all the machine learning and the voice recognition software that's making a decision, and then it's sending messages back that are then controlling other always on things that are listening for the smart light bulb that's on the network all the time just so you can switch the light on. So I'm trying to think back to our previous studies, but the more of these devices you have in the home, the more you're weaving in energy demand in the cloud, in these data centers, in these voice processing units, and also those the baseline energy demand of your home is going up with each of those appliances, because it's like the refrigerator. It's always on, it's always in the background, it's always ready to get your voice command. So and it all adds up. I forget where we are in terms of energy demand in the home, but it's there's an increasing footprint of IT as a result of this.
And it's not just getting heavier because of the number of systems and how complicated the systems like that are, that, you know, if I'm telling Siri to turn the light on, that's involving satellites or whatever it is to get the sound backwards and forwards.
Exactly. I think the other thing that's happening is increasingly the system is doing speculative processing for us. It's doing deep learning with, you know, lots and lots of computation to try and look at the patterns across all the different households that are interacting with it, and it's speculatively doing computation to look at all the things you might be asking for next and sort of making helpful suggestions about the next thing you might like to buy, for example, which is all using, you know, massively more energy in the cloud side than it's using at that device that's at the endpoint in your home.
And Kelly Widdox's research includes things like the new ways of watching.
Yeah, so Kelly's work is really interesting. So we always like to do these mixed method studies where we're logging what people do, and then we use the data to take visualizations back to people and get them to help us with the understanding of the patterns of what they do. So Kelly's work is about understanding where and on what device and for how long people watch and consume video content or network services more generally. I think the current projections say that something like 35% of all internet traffic is video. And actually, scratch that, I think it might be closer to 50%, but 35% is Netflix and YouTube or something like that. So it's very quickly becoming the dominating traffic on the internet.
And the ideas of the whole family sitting around watching one TV is shifting to...
Well,
several things going on in the room.
It's shifting to this together alone phenomenon. People are sitting together, but they're all engaged on their own personal content streams, or they're you will see people interacting with other friends in their social network around the content that they're watching. But it's different to the content that everyone else in the room is also watching. Yeah.
So your job title.
Hmm.
Is what?
I got to choose my job title.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun, because when you get your chair, when you become a professor, you could be a professor of computer science. But I went for professor of computing and sustainability because I wanted when people found me on the people page, you know, or looked at the institution, I wanted them to say that person has an interest in sustainability, and, you know, if I want to know more about that, I want to speak to that person about it. So,
is the and important? Is it two separate things, or is it one thing?
That's an interesting question. I think the link is important for me because I still think of myself as a computer scientist, and I still try and speak in part. I think I see myself increasingly as a multidisciplinary researcher, because you can't address sustainability from a computer science perspective alone. It just doesn't make sense without thinking of psychology or sociology or economics or political theory, philosophy. You know, it's something that's sufficiently broad. We have to change the way we are doing things. And the value to me comes from channeling that influence back into the discipline to try and make it an agent for change towards a more sustainable future.
Your research group is a socio-digital sustainability team.
Yeah, so we picked that. We thought quite hard about that title. We didn't want to be STS in a sociology sense, because we're not speaking about sociology theory, really. And the digital and the social are equally important. I think part of the reason I'm at HCI is it's one of the few conferences where researchers innately understand that their technology is situated in the world and that they have to speak to people and co-design and with people and stakeholders. And that gives me a certain amount of hope that it's a community that care about the impact the technology is having on the world and on people. I want to help shift the community, in a sense, to think about sustainability impacts in the design of their technologies as well.
And it brings up the fact that those are systems that are complicated and sort of convoluted, and we're not likely to find the single switch that we can say, we're trying to improve energy behaviour, well, we'll just turn it to the green dial.
I think there is a perception that green technology will save us. I think engineers think we will do carbon capture and storage, for example, which means we carry on generating energy in the same carbon intense way we do. We just fix it with technology, or we make the home smart and therefore the smart home will be more efficient, and because it's more efficient it will be more sustainable. I personally don't believe the future is more of the same. I think we have to be more resilient, and we have to have a lower footprint in terms of our resource utilization, both directly in energy terms but also in terms of the materials we use in creating the technology as well. So we're going to have to, if we accept we're going to have to live differently, I'm interested in how technology can be a voice for helping us reach that. But I accept there is a sort of fairly fundamental paradox in trying to do that simultaneously as a technologist and someone who cares about sustainability.
Yeah, you said you loved creating new things, and that's partly the problem.
Yeah.
Not just computing, but we as a society like new stuff.
We love new stuff, and we have, I would say, got a bit hooked on new stuff and more convenience and more products, and in a sense we are. There's a very nice book about resource utilization by Hugo Bardi, who's in the Club of Rome, and some of the materials we're using are really rare. When we talk about, oh, electric cars will save us, right? I mean, they will save us in a sense that we will reduce pollution at the point of use, but what's the big picture thinking? You know, have we the energy and the materials to make that transition? And I actually think computational systems also have a role in helping us sort of model some of these counterfactual futures and think about, you know, how are we going to reshape society in a more sustainable direction as well, although that hasn't been a focus of my work so far.
We've mostly been talking about energy, but you've worked in a whole pile of fields, from transport. You're working some in transport mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. and you've done some work in food practice and various other things. Is there a common set of principles that can be seen through that?
Yeah, I think I'm interested in socio-technical systems, which is where the socio-digital sustainability title partly comes from. And if you look at where people's lives have impact, I think I've not consciously, but I've been walking round that sort of pie chart of impacts and exploring, you know, can I understand thermal comfort and how people keep warm and the energy impacts and carbon impacts of that? Can I look at food and diet and say, you know, some of our past work looks at how much energy does it take to prepare the food we eat, but also what are the impacts of the diet we're eating and which is the greater? And it turns out for most foods, the supply chain impacts are 5 times the direct energy impact. So the real question is, if you're good designing a shopping app, don't design it based on cooking time, design it based on the ingredients and get people to choose different food. So it helps you think differently about the design technology if you dig into those domains.
What are you doing in the transport space?
So in transport, we've been looking at last mile logistics, which is parcel delivery in the centre of London. And the interesting question is, as the number of vans and delivery vehicles is just going up and up and up, and the more we do on-demand shopping and these kind of things, the more of these light commercial vehicles are on the road. So what we've been doing is exploring how could you start to collapse, you know, can you try to work out how inefficient that's being, you know, with all those different delivery services going to the same addresses? Are they on the same street at the same time? Is there an overlap in what they're trying to do? And what are the barriers in getting them to work together just to collapse some of those services together? Can you chart that potential? And then can we come up with digital services that help those businesses who fundamentally are trying to get competitive advantage over each other and don't want to collaborate? How do we get them to collaborate to reduce that impact by working together?
Because it used to be that there was the post office, the milkman. So, I mean, there wouldn't have been many people doing it.
So I think, ironically, the privatisation of that has led to much greater numbers of vehicles. A common service, a post office, would have been way more efficient. The other nice finding, once you started, you know, instrumenting the working with the drivers, shadowing them, measuring where they went with data loggers and so on, what we also discovered is actually they walk as much as they drive. So they park, and there's an awful lot of knowledge that they need to know where's a good place to park to optimize so that they can carry enough stuff to multiple delivery addresses. So if you treat it as a classic computer science problem of how do I drive to all these destinations and deliver all these parcels in a day, what they achieve is actually impossible. But because they park and walk half the time, that they are much, much more efficient, and they're obviously much more sustainable as a result of that. So then we can think differently about designing those delivery systems and say, well, it's more about where are they going to stop, how to organise what they're carrying, and also as one of the stakeholders is Transport for London, while they're stopped, they're taking up parking. So can you think differently about the use of the streets to facilitate this, to keep the sustainable behaviour without congesting your roads?
It's interesting that you see describe that as a classic computer science problem. In fact, it's one literally classic, the travelling salesman
problem.
Very classic problem. But on the mixed into there, and as we were talking about the socio-digital, is the social impact of that kind of move to that sort of work. It's harder to see how you can describe that in terms of
a computer
classical science computer science problems.
I think it is, but I think where computer science starts to have a role for me is in talking to some of the other stakeholders. So can you then, if you can influence the policymakers like Transport for London and say, look what's happening on your streets, you could design your streets differently, or people could design their buildings differently to receive parcels in different ways, reduce the curb dwell time, encourage the walking behaviour, or think about regulation, you know, low emission zones, congestion zones, handing over to sustainable last mile delivery, then that's a model that you might want to replicate and in other cities. And I think that's something we're using computation to try and illustrate.
Is computing sustainable?
I don't think it's on a sustainable trajectory, to be honest with you. We are addicted to the growth curve, as is all of society, really. The classic Moore's Law, you know, doubling of computing every 18 months or whatever. We are very good at designing equipment that's going to be obsolete very quickly. We create an escalation in the same way as you have a demand for physical products, you have a demand for software products with more features. So we're not very content with keeping these things the same. So people are changing their hardware to have increased capability to keep up with the software. We're changing our software because we want more features, and we're locked into a cycle of updates. And each of these pieces of technology have increasingly tiny amounts of precious metals and things that are very hard to recycle. So we're burning our way through precious resources to create the computational infrastructure. So I think a really interesting challenge for software engineering and computer engineering is how you create systems with more longevity that aren't so profligate in their use of resources. I think that's there's some very hard and interesting questions about how we design our software and our systems to last.
And that we want to last.
That we want to last, yeah. I mean, the first recognition, I think, is that if we want to sustain ourselves as a species on a finite world, then we have to have a different attitude to how we burn through resources.
Because we want this phone to die so we can buy the new one.
And also the company want the phone to die so you buy the new one, because that's how they keep growing as well. So yeah, at the moment it's not in their interest to have you keep your phone for a long time.
So there's the social questions, there's the ethical questions, business model questions. How do we prepare, not necessarily people who are going to come through your lab in a postgrad space, but the hordes of computer science students? How are we setting them up?
Well, I don't think we're setting them up very well. We're setting them up very well in terms of their ability to learn programming languages, their ability to cope with a very fast-moving workplace in terms of technology and programming languages. But I think, generally speaking, sustainability is not a feature of most computer science curricula. I think it's also very hard to appreciate when you're going to move into a fast moving industry for your work, which is predicated on, you know, shipping technology to people and the current sort of economic models. It's quite hard to get people to challenge that, but we, in my view, we have to start. It's part to me of a whole set of responsibilities about the analogy I use at Open Days is one from medicine. So you don't particularly want a doctor in the world who can't demonstrate their competence and their responsibility to their patients, because then people will get killed. Increasingly, technologists are developing software that is going into the world that can have life and death implications, like, you know, famous examples of self-driving cars, or, you know, we're increasingly important links in healthcare chains and things that affect, you know, really affect people's lives in a very direct way. So we have to be responsible practitioners, in my view.
It's obvious if you're designing the control systems for an aeroplane, the 737 MAX example.
And even that's not easy to get right, it seems.
But that's an obvious teaching moment that we can use.
Mm-hmm.
Because planes falling out of the sky is clearly a bad thing.
It's fairly obvious when you when you get it wrong.
It's harder to use those sorts of arguments or to get them across for the unfortunate slow burn problems.
Yeah, so some of the sort of case law, if you like, is easier around security problems, ethics, privacy, you know. But I think it's reasonable to talk about resource use. It's reasonable to talk about. You can start, I think, by measuring and seeing energy impacts from computation, and talking about things computer scientists understand, like efficiency, and that one algorithm is going to be more energy efficient than another. And then I think one of the challenges is when people are focused on a particular thing, like becoming a really good computer scientist, they're not really there to become, you know, necessarily a sustainable computer scientist. So I think there is a challenge in how you communicate that in an engaging way.
How did you become a sustainable computer scientist?
I think I probably started being more aware of it during a sabbatical, where I was increasingly aware of environmental concerns, and I visited Cambridge, where they were working on a set of work called Computing for the Future of the Planet, and they asked me hard questions like, well, what's computing got to do with, you know, can you be a computer scientist and have any impact in sustainability terms? And I think I took that as a bit of a challenge, and it also lined up very nicely with a sort of midlife crisis moment where I thought, you know, my work is potentially having impacts on the world, but have I really thought about what those impacts are? And certainly I hadn't in sustainability terms, and I was merrily putting Ubicomp technologies into the world without thinking about these things. And I found that very motivating, and I think I started reading books like How Bad Are Bananas by Mike Berners-Lee, and Sustainability Without the Hot Air, and various things which sort of started me realizing that everyone has to get engaged with this, and if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So that was a sort of defining moment, really.
Some of those people that I listed before, students of yours or of your department. I know that at least one of them didn't come in as a sustainability person who is now very passionate about it. Is there a process? Is it an active process of engaging people?
I don't think we explicitly set out to convert anyone. I guess there is a certain amount of zealotry around sustainability anyway. But I think once you get involved in the work, you start to appreciate that there's an opportunity to try and do something here, and then I think people do become passionate about it. I think for too long we've been going on in a bit of a bubble that computing is all digital, it's all virtual, it doesn't have an impact on the world, and I don't think that's true. We're seeing impacts on politics, impacts on environment, impacts on privacy. It's changing and reshaping things. It has a power and a scale that we didn't think was going to be there. So I think it is. It's quite motivating.
You talked about those hard questions that you were asked when you visited Cambridge. Have those hard questions continued?
I think I asked those questions of myself all the time, because I suppose I'm not doing hardcore computer science in a sense, or at least a lot of my peers would say that. You know, I'm not trying to invent the next quantum processor or the next programming language. But I still think that there is potential to help address this problem.
Because some of the people that you've worked with, I'm thinking now of Bran Knowles, who's coming at it from a very much a values positioning, and her, you might summarise this better than me, but essentially if we're pandering to people's wallet in order to do sustainability, then we're doing it actually disservice.
I think a very difficult challenge for business and academia to address sustainability is that it in some ways is framed by your ability to get money, which is predicated on the very system you're questioning. And I think that's really, really hard, and is possibly why I feel that academics have at the moment a special freedom to ask these questions. But as I see the increasing pushing together of business targets and government targets around business and academia, I see these questions are potentially getting harder to ask, or at least ask with funded research.
Are you having fun?
Yeah, I think so. I think I get to do work that is genuinely extremely hard to do well, very challenging, intellectually engaging. So I guess, yes. I wouldn't say it's straightforward, and I think there are easier ways to be a successful academic, frankly. But
mostly you are still getting to build new stuff, but you're building new stuff as means to understand systems better.
Yeah, I think that's right. I see it as a method of scientific inquiry. I call it sort of Ubicomp as a scientific lens. I think it feels a little bit different to putting technology in an environment so that it's always there to support people, although that might be an outcome. It's more about, at the moment, how do we understand how sustainable we're being or not? What are the social technical practices around that are leading to those impacts? And then can we do things to kind of make them more visible?
So your work's not about, here's this miracle cure that is going to solve sustainability.
No, I think in that sense, I'm a bit of an opportunist in that there is a role for computational systems in helping communicate with people, and also as acting as a bridge to allow society to configure in new ways to do things that are more sustainable.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
No. I think the only thing
you
I would
got it in your job title.
Oh, I know. So for me, I'd call it environmental sustainability. So I'm interested in the what are the energy and carbon impacts. So that as an externality, I think what I would define it not as is business sustainability. That's often conflated.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I think we were able to respond to a call for evidence from the Freight Transport Project, where we talked about the role of walking and this sort of hybrid routing problem in the City of London, and I'm hoping that will change policy there, so I can see the potential for a larger impact from that than some of the other areas. I'm currently engaged in a thermal comfort study where I'm trying to change practice at the university so that we can reduce the amount of heat that's being wasted throughout the building by better working and changing the working practices in the buildings there. And we're involved with a company who want to create that as a system that you can sell. So I think that's another one that I'm hoping will have impact.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes.
Okay.
And you're in the mansion.
Thank you.
What's your superpower? What got you there?
My superpower?
Yeah.
My superpower is computer science, I think. It's being able to create my vision through the power of programming. As I say on the open days, you know, it's one of those tools that lets you create the future and realise your dreams, in a sense. I mean, it sounds a bit saccharine, but actually, I mean, some of the you could be passionate about crowdfunding for charity or transforming cancer care or something. You could go out and help people achieve that with your programming superpower. And so, I'm going to apply my programming superpower to trying to save the planet, and hopefully I will earn my place in your book with hindsight.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I don't consider myself to be an activist. I guess in my quiet way, perhaps within the university, but I constantly feel I should practice more of what I preach. Yeah, I still haven't gone vegan.
When you go off to the Senate or whatever the appropriate structures are, do other people roll their eyes? Here he goes again.
Not obviously. But neither has it been an easy journey to get them to own environmental sustainability at a senior level. And in that sense, you require a really dogged determination not to give up. And I think we all need that because it's really important. And, you know, if we give up, we know where that leads.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I think I just have a work ethic, actually. I think that comes from my parents. I would never want to be idle, and I do have a passion for this topic, and in a sense that's strangely a little bit selfless, in that it's probably not the career maker if I was purely self-centered, but I do think it's really important and worth dedicating yourself to.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
I think we've demonstrated we can speak to an academic audience pretty well, but I think there are really huge challenges around academia and how we address the climate change emergency, and think, how are we going to stop flying all the way around the world to address a topic which like this? I think we have to have more impact to help change thinking around this topic politically, and I think that's very hard for us to do, but essential.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
I think I would have... I'd want a global summit where the conversation wasn't about economic growth, it was about climate change. And not about how do we make money out of environmental sustainability, but how we really think we want our society to be. So I think a deep internalization of the challenges ahead of us, in the sort of leadership is what I require.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Probably if you haven't already, read one of Mike Berners-Lee's books, like There Is No Planet B.
He's at Lancaster, isn't he?
He is at Lancaster, yeah. He's a collaborator of mine, but he does the carbon footprint of everything, really, whatever he's asked to footprint, and he has some really interesting ideas of... There's definitely this idea that sustainability is about giving things up, and actually I think sustainability is often about valuing the human and doing things differently, and if we do it right, we can have quiet roads with less pollution and places for the kids to play and better, more wildlife and lots of benefits for humankind that we're not currently realizing. And I think that's engage with the impacts and then lobby politicians so it's clear that it's important to you, so that they start thinking about it as well.
Thank you very much for joining me.
A great pleasure.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show's co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here because I run away and I'm in Glasgow. Each week we talk with somebody who's making a positive difference to try to see the world through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Professor Adrian Friday from the University of Lancaster. You can find Sustainable Lens in all the poddy sorts of places, especially with the archive on sustainablelens.org. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic,
we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.